Today, my guest is Natalie Nidam, biohacker, epigenetic coach, and peptide expert. We talk about where to start on your health journey.
Any person in the biohacking space worth their salt is going to start with, how are you sleeping? How are you managing your stress? How are you feeding your body? Are you spending any time in nature at all? And what are you putting into your body? Like, what are you eating?
Living longer, being fit and healthy, and how to get there.
I want to live a long time, and I want to be kicking ass the whole time. And we now can see that that is possible.
We also dive into the nitty-gritty of peptides and why they could be the answer to many of our illnesses today.
Basically, this body protective compound peptide can be incredibly powerful for healing of muscles, tendons, and ligaments. So that would be musculoskeletal injuries. It can be very powerful for healing any part of the GI tract. So from the mouth all the way to the other end and everything in between.
I saw you at the Health Optimization Summit actually about 6 weeks ago now, and I've been following your podcast for some time, which I think is amazing. And I've started my own quest into biohacking, and who better to have as a guest on my show? But literally, I want to call you the queen of biohacking.
But certainly, thank you.
you've had some great insights into everything from biohacking, health, fitness, and peptides, which I can't wait to get into the nitty-gritty of that. But before we get started, Natalie, could you give me a little bit of your background and what made you so passionate about this space?
100%, with pleasure. Thank you for asking. So basically, you know, my journey is, it's a long journey, as it is for so many people. And, you know, in the biohacking space, maybe mine's a little bit longer because I've been around a bit longer. But basically, you know, how I came to this was a real evolution of my life. And so many of us come to this because of our own personal health journey. For me, I was always interested in science. I was always interested in the human experience. I was, you know, as I was explaining to you, I was that kid who'd be buried in National Geographic all the time. And it was a toss up between, was it the animals? Was it the people stories? Was it the science stories? Like, I just found that whole thing so fascinating. And, you know, the other thing I think that really brought me here was that I had my own personal health journey. And, you know, as a C-section baby, my mom wasn't able to nurse me as desperately as she wanted to, unfortunately, which really set me up with a really depleted microbiome right out of the gate, which set me up for a lot of antibiotics as a little kid, which ultimately, you know, generates its own kind of journey. And so, as we were saying, when we grow up in a state like that, and especially in those days, there was so much less conversation and awareness around these things that you just normalize. And even now, people who come to me for coaching, or I'm sure your clients, people come to us and they say, you know, I'm fine. I eat a healthy diet. I'm okay. But I really just want to lose these 20, 30, 40, whatever pounds, or, you know, 10, 15 stones. I'm not sure about the conversion.
Kilos.
kilos. And when we start to dig in, we start to realize that people have normalized so many symptoms, and they think they're eating a healthy diet, but they don't realize what healthy even means anymore, because there's so much conflict and so much polarization in the space. So anyway, so I had these health issues. I studied physiology in university. Somewhere along the way, I got lost. I ended up in advertising, sales, and marketing through most of my adult life. But I was a fitness instructor as well the whole time, pretty much until about 10 or 12 years ago. And so I always kind of had a hand in health and helping people with their health and helping myself with my health, and always looking for what's that thing. And I myself fell prey, right? It was like, oh, it's not about the pasta. It's about what you put on the pasta. Then it was like, okay, maybe the pasta is not so good. Maybe I need to be eating this. Oh no, wait, they're telling me that meat gives cancer. Holy crap. Maybe I shouldn't be eating that. And then the next thing you know, it's something else and something else. And so that, you know, we now have two choices. Either we just kind of throw our arms up in the air and say, look, I'm just going to eat whatever, block my ears and hope for the best. Or we look around us, we notice that even in our families, like in my family, type 2 diabetes runs like wildfire. Things like arthritis are really prevalent. And now we start to dig a little bit, and then we start to realize, wait a minute, a lot of these things are preventable. A lot of these diseases that are being told people, well, you know, you're just getting older, actually are preventable diseases. And so that kind of lit up my interest a little bit. And without getting into too much detail, 12 years ago, I woke up one morning and decided I was going to become a holistic nutritionist because my other passion, of course, is food. So what better way to kind of deliver the message? And from there, I then was a member of the first class of Bulletproof Human Potential Coaches, which are now only called Human Potential Coaches. And then from there, that was really great in terms of acquiring tools to help people change their behavior, which, as you know, there's no shortage of information in the world. Theoretically, everybody should be able to change whatever they don't like about themselves, but curating that information and then changing our behavior, two different things, right? And then finally, epigenetics was the next thing that kind of caught my eye. So understanding how does our environment, either from the outside or even our inside and internal environment, affect the expression of our genes. And then the last kind of rabbit hole, I'll say, that I fell down that I still haven't really come out of was this whole world of peptides and peptide bioregulators. And this is where really this whole world of longevity and health span, because, you know, I think as certainly in more developed countries or first world countries, I don't know what the proper term is anymore, but in countries where we're less concerned about dying of infectious diseases or starvation, that we've solved for living a long time. What we haven't particularly solved is living a long time and being healthy and vibrant. And this is where I think the real work lives and the opportunity presents itself to us.
Wow, Natalie. Well, that's quite a background into that. Why do you think, I mean, you've talked about, you know, your fascination with the health side of things and longevity side. Why do you think people are so fascinated, I guess, now in aging, rather than, say, our parents' generation? I know it's something I never heard my mother talk about or my grandparents talk about, sort of this whole, you know, it was like, oh, we're going to live till 70 or 80 and then that's it. There was no question then of, oh, we're going to go on and live till, you know, 100, 120 now, I think, mm-hmm. is really what the number of people are talking about. Where do you think that fascination comes from?
Well, I think that humanity has always been obsessed with not dying, right? I think what is the difference now, again, because the medical world has really solved, I mean, less so in the last couple of years, maybe, but they've really solved this problem of dying of preventable infectious diseases, let's say. And we've taken a lot of things off the map. And so we've gotten to the point where we have the luxury of thinking, okay, I not only do I want to live a long time, but now I'm realizing that if my only goal is to live a long time, there's a reasonable chance I'm going to end up in a wheelchair, wearing diapers, gnashing my gums, not knowing who I am and where I come from and who the next person is that comes in the room. And there's a point of this that's almost a sense of entitlement that I want to live a long time and I want to be kicking ass the whole time. And we now can see that that is possible. The technologies are developing. The regenerative medicine is coming out, and it's becoming more accessible to people who are closer and closer to the mainstream, right? And so our parents didn't think about stem cell treatments or exosomes, or they didn't even know that there was such a thing. And if that even existed at that time, it was so outside the realm of what was accessible to them that it just wasn't a factor. Now, plus with social media, you and I can go through Instagram and come across like 27 different accounts of people who are doing jaw-dropping things with technology, like health technology and regenerative medicine. And we're sitting there going, oh, wow, like this is actually potentially attainable.
So where, I mean, where do people start? Because if you're sort of new to this whole area and you're like, you're listening to this and thinking, wow, these ladies are talking about living to 100, 120, and yet living with a good health span rather than just living long for the sake of it. Where should people sort of start on this journey if they want to make sure that they are in the best, well, have the best quality of life as they grow old? Mm-hmm.
So this is the part where people are going to roll their eyes and go, seriously, that's all you got? But I do believe that it starts with the basics. I do believe, and you know, we talk about the term biohacking, which can be very intimidating to a lot of people. But if you really look at what biohacking really focuses on these days, before you get to the regenerative stuff, before you get to the peptides and the peptide bioregulators, any person in the biohacking space worth their salt is going to start with, how are you sleeping? How are you managing your stress? How are you feeding your body? Are you spending any time in nature at all? And what are you putting into your body? Like, what are you eating? So it's the best place to start. If you have no concept of any of this stuff and you're kind of caught in these spirals that modern life traps us into, where we are on our technology 24/7, we're eating convenience foods because it's all we have time for, or that's how we were raised. You know, a lot of people now are a generation of people that whose parents bought into the packaged foods, who, and maybe did it because they had no choice, because their mom was a single mom and just trying to keep the wheels on the bus. Or maybe their both parents were working and they had no time, like whatever the reason is. You know, I think that biohacking, as much as it's about all this fancy advanced stuff, it's also about, if you really listen and watch what people are talking about, a lot of it is about reconnecting to nature and the natural world and getting our foundation set so that we can reach this state called homeostasis, which is essentially a state of balance. And from there, we can start to think about optimizing. And I would say that I wouldn't put it out there that the goal is 100 or 120 necessarily, because to some people that just sounds exhausting, honestly. I think the goal is to live, I mean, as long as possible, but as well as possible, right? So that, and we see it today. And frankly, there have been people for generations behind us who could live into their 70s, 80s, and 90s and be vibrant. They were the minority, but they were the people, if you look at it, who, number one, were blessed with really good genetics, but number two, really kind of stayed connected to community. That's the other one I didn't mention, like stayed connected to community. Like you would hear about people living in the Swiss mountains in Switzerland, right? Who are hiking, and you look at them and you go, wow, that 60-year-old looks amazing, but actually the 60-year-old's 80. And you know, right? So I think that those people have always been around. It's just now there's more of them and there are more of us who want what they have.
I completely agree. And actually, I do think that's one area that a lot of people sort of miss out in this. You know, we talk about, as you say, the sleep, the diet and exercise, and we'll come on more to the sort of more advanced stuff. But actually the one thing, and you know, people sometimes say to me, oh, you look great for your age, and you know, what are your secrets? And I'm very much into the diet, the exercise, sleeping. That's the one little issue that I have, but I try my best and all the rest of it. But also, I absolutely love to have fun. Yes. And I think, and being around my friends, and my community, and that to me is such an important part of life. If you can't laugh and have that real sort of belly laugh and really feel like you're connecting with people, mm-hmm. I think that is such an important thing that we sometimes miss in these conversations.
100%. I mean, if you even look at the data on the negative impact of stress on your immune function, right? Like when that expression, laughter is the best medicine, it's not, it's true. And it's, if we can't laugh, if we can't have fun, I mean, look at the last 2 to 3 years, right? Coming out of this pandemic, man, those are the last 2 to 3 years that fun forgot. And the people that came through the best are the people that were able to maintain a sense of optimism, that were able to create community around them, to stay connected to people in whatever way. The people that suffered the most were people who were alone and isolated, right? I mean, look at what happened in old age homes, right? People became super isolated. There was nobody really who was able to care for them. And, you know, on top of all the other reasons why things went south over there, that's a big part of how people decline. And we know, even with people who have cognitive decline, very often if they don't have stimulation, if they're not connected to other people, if they don't have family and community around them, their decline is going to happen a lot faster. Yes. So this piece of community, connection, joy, fun, all of those pieces are critical and sometimes can even make up for an imperfect diet or an imperfect, you know, like it can buy you some wiggle room in those spaces.
Let's come on to diet a little bit, because everyone talks about diet. And I think that's the one that we get bombarded with: this diet, that diet. I've been on hundreds of diets in my years. Oh my gosh, I can't tell you some of them. Cereal twice a day, and that'll be great for you. I mean, there was all sorts. South Beach, this one. Is there a particular diet that you advocate for the most?
I think the only thing I advocate for is eating a whole food diet, right? I think that would be the only blanket statement I'd be willing to make. Beyond that, it's going to be dependent on 1,000 different factors, starting with, I do believe that your background, your ethnic background, has a lot to do with what may be the best diet for you, right? If you come from generations of people that ate a lot of starch, there's a reasonable chance that you're genetically will have adapted to break down starch. So you may have more copies of a gene called the amylase gene, which is a gene that breaks down starch. If you come from a group of people, like for generations, that ate a lot of fat and very little vegetables, like, you know, here, like we have people living in the far north who never saw a vegetable. Now, it turns out that in those cases, they're not always the longest lived people, but they were very healthy and very robust, and their bodies adapted to that diet. So if you suddenly take that person and throw them into a Mediterranean country, they might not do so well. So I think that your background has something to do with what might be the best diet for you. But of course, what's going to override that is your current state of health, your stage of life, and, you know, your what's possible for you in terms of your taste, that kind of stuff. But at the end of the day, nothing is going to override the fact that if we don't eat real food, things are not going to go well for us. And I do believe fundamentally that we are meant to be omnivores for the most part. So eat some meat, some fish, some chicken, some vegetables, that kind of stuff. But that doesn't mean that people can't thrive on a vegan diet. We could trot out a couple of examples of vegans who thrive, they're long lived, they're vibrant, they're amazing. And then on the other side, as you said, you know, you've got the carnivore crew who are like, oh my God, those people, they're going to blow up in 10 minutes. Meanwhile, other people are looking at them going, dude, you're going down. Right? So.
Well, you just beat me to that next question, because I was going to ask you on your thoughts on vegan diets. Coming from a world of, you know, I try and put on as much muscle as I can. So I'm a big advocate for protein and eating adequate amounts of good quality protein.
Yeah.
Maybe I shouldn't say this, but, you know, I believe everyone should have their own opinions and their own views, and it's that your own body. But vegans do struggle to get enough good quality protein in, I would say.
Well, I think it's hard to be a vegan. I think it's a lot of work to be a good vegan and to thrive. Two things. One, you have to, the problem with any of these extreme diets, and particularly in the vegan vegetarian world, there's a lot of philosophical, emotional, and now political drivers that are influencing people, which has very little to do with, are you providing your body with what it needs? And so I'm not here to talk anybody out of or into anything. But bottom line, if you're going to be a vegan, and if you're, you know, or anything on that spectrum, then you do have to pay attention to what is it that your body needs and how is it that you're going to give your body. I can tell you that it's not going to be by eating Beyond Burgers and tofurkey and all of these ultra processed foods that people are making to try and, you know, give someone the experience of a burger. I mean, if you're a vegan and you want a burger, chop up some fermented, like some sprouted nuts and seeds and mushrooms and, you know, some soaked and sprouted grains and mix it up with some good herbs and spices. And then you'll have like what can be a burger for you. But if you'd start, you know, Italy just passed a law banning lab grown meat. You know, the Italians, for all their flaws, that is one of the smartest things I've heard in a really yes. long time, because I think that lab grown meat is like, it's such a bad idea on so many different levels. It is such a, it's such an arrogant point of view on the behalf of humanity to think that we can reproduce for our bodies, not just the calories and the vitamins and, well, frankly, I don't even think they're thinking about vitamins and minerals, but they're, you know, not just the calories, the carbs, the fats, the proteins, the macronutrients, but let's not forget that food is information for our cells. And there are many, I believe there are many components of food we have no idea about energetically, about how it influences our body. So if you're going to be a vegan, do your work, do the work. Inform yourself, learn about how you can possibly provide, and then with any luck, be open to the possibility that maybe this, you're not going to be able to thrive on this diet, and that you may have to incorporate other foods that you struggle with, right?
And where do you stand on, say, supplementation and supplementing? In terms of supplementing, I'm not going to say a bad diet, because I don't think we can possibly supplement a bad diet, really. We've got to eat the whole foods, but what are your views on supplements?
I think supplements are just that. They're supplements, right? So supplements are in addition to, right? Like the word supplement implies it. They're in addition to what is possible to get out of your diet. You know, we all have this fantasy that we're going to be able to get everything that we need out of the food that we eat. And maybe, I don't know, maybe 50, 100 years ago, maybe that was possible. At this stage of the game, we're dealing with a food supply that it's extremely challenged by depleted soils, that is extremely challenged by, you know, access, like even the way that people are growing food. And so I think at this stage of the game, we're in a world where some degree of supplementation is going to be important for most people, but not blindly, right? So getting insight into where you may have weak spots. So some of that, you can get insight sometimes from your genetics about your body has an easier time. Like, for example, just so I'm not speaking in theoretical terms, I come from a Mediterranean background. My body was designed to be in the sun a lot. We're not going to talk about my skin. Let's just say my body was designed to be in the sun a lot. As a result, my genes are structured in such a way that I'm very slow at converting sunlight into vitamin D in my system. So that means that now that I live in a place where there's not a lot of sun a lot of the time, not to mention the fact that we have a tendency to walk around fully clothed most of the time, right? Even when it is sunny. I need to supplement with vitamin D3, right? Because my vitamin D levels have a tendency to be low because my body adapted to being exposed to sunlight all the time. So in a perfect world, if I'm running around, you know, exposing a lot of skin in a lot of sun, I'm less likely to become vitamin D toxic. But I will have the opportunity to make as much vitamin D as I need. So, and that doesn't mean, it doesn't mean that if, let's say, some people from a genetic perspective, the pathway for bringing iron from the outside of the cell into the cell is kind of, it's a slower pathway. It's not fully optimized. So those people might have a tendency to be low in iron. So what we do with that genetic information is we now run labs to see what's actually showing up in the person. And then we're able to say, okay, so, you know, you're iron deficient, your body has trouble doing this. There might be something we might be able to do to help that pathway along, Or we might say to this person, look, you're going to have to make sure that you're getting a lot of good quality iron. And that enlists a whole other conversation, right? I mean, to me, the best source of iron we can get is probably liver, whether it's eating liver or taking desiccated liver capsules. That's going to be a form of liver that is very bioavailable to your body. It's delivering the iron in conjunction with other nutrients that it works synergistically with, like, for example, copper. There's going to be vitamin A in there. There's going to be methylated B vitamins. There's going to be all kinds of stuff that is very bioavailable for your body. So supplementation, yes. And then the other thing about supplementation, I'll say, is as we are raising the bar on how we want to live and how long we want to live and how we want to perform, we might have to take some supplements that our grandparents didn't take or didn't know about or didn't have access to, right?
And that's what I was going to come on to. As I've got older and I've just turned 52, the way how I supplement myself is very much different to 10 years ago. And then probably 20 years ago, even I probably didn't, I don't think I took anything back then. It was just, I don't think I thought about it.
Exactly.
Are there supplements that you would suggest, I guess, more for a woman, let's say a woman that maybe is in her early 50s, late 40s, probably going through the change, gone through the menopause or coming up to the menopause? Is there anything that you would sort of recommend in that area?
So I mean, it's going to be different based on the person, but I think that as we're going through menopause, as we're coming up to menopause and going through menopause, there are certain systems in our body we really need to pay attention to. So for example, the adrenal glands, which may already be struggling from, if you had children, if you live a stressful life, adrenal glands are very critical for helping our bodies to deal with the stress. They are intrinsically linked to the thyroid gland, which in so many women, so many people, frankly, even men, is not operating at an optimal level. So working with a provider who can help to give you insight into those systems to see how they're functioning and giving them the support, because if you're not coming in stressed, you're getting stressed. Like, menopause is a stressful time. Things are starting to shift. We become more insulin resistant. We lose the benefit of having estrogen when we need it, where we need it. So, I don't love giving blanket statements. I just think that now's the time. If you haven't been diligent about going to the doctor, getting regular checkups, and really getting good blood work done in labs to see where you're at, not accepting the status quo, not accepting the, oh, you're fine, but I feel horrible. Yeah, but you're fine. Your blood work's fine. That four-letter word, we need to excise, right? We need to find those physicians who are willing to walk with us and not say to us, oh, you're feeling hot and sweaty and bloated and you've put on 10 pounds and your cramps all of a sudden are crippling. Well, welcome to perimenopause and menopause. Enjoy the ride. We don't need to accept that anymore. There's so much we can do about it. We have to take care of our liver. We have to make sure that our digestion is optimized. There's so many things we can do to support our bodies naturally. But then I'm also personally, under the care of a physician, of course, I'm a huge proponent for bioidentical hormone replacement therapy. And
so sorry, go on.
No, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, I'm obviously very much into my own body health, fitness, and I went through that sort of transition period, or I didn't actually know I was going through that, but when I sort of looked up the symptoms, and it was going through this sort of the COVID time, so I just put my sort of depression and my waking up in the middle of the night constantly down to, oh, we're going through terrible times, you know, maybe it's playing on my mind, all the rest of it. And then my libido dropped off a cliff.
Yeah, that's another good sign, yeah.
Okay, well, maybe it's just, that's it, done. And it wasn't until I really started researching and realized, this is just, I've just hit this period of time. And when I went to the doctors, I really did demand to see somebody that was a specialist in the menopause. And I would say anyone that's listening, certainly in the UK, with the NHS system, you can ask to have a doctor that is specialized in this area and they will hear you now, and you know, don't go without sort of really understanding what they're saying to you. And if you're not happy, ask for tests, ask for the yeah. blood work, which I did. And you know, I'm very happy to say, you know, I'm on the HRT and testosterone as well, actually.
100%. What I was going to say is that with bioidentical hormone therapy, a lot of we get resistance from a lot of women for two different reasons. One is fear, and I get the fear, but the truth of the matter is that an educated physician will be able to guide you so that the risks are virtually non-existent. Plus, you should be getting monitored and tested along the way. And there will be some women for who hormone replacement isn't exactly right. And there might be other methods that they can access. But the other one is, well, you know, hormone replacement is not natural, and I don't want to do something that's not natural. And I'm like, that's fine. But that brings us back to the beginning of our conversation, where our grandmothers and our mother, sometimes our mothers, depending on our age and who our moms were, they didn't even think about the fact that they demanded to be vibrant and look amazing and function at a certain level into their 70s, 80s, and 90s. We are going, fundamentally, we're kind of going against Mother Nature here, right? Mother Nature keeps us youthful and amazing looking during our reproductive years. She keeps us around long enough to raise our babies. And when we're done with that, she's kind of like, okay, your time to exit stage left and make space for the next people. Maybe there's wisdom in that, but we're not accepting that anymore. This is not okay for us. And so if we want an outcome that's different, then we're going to have to do things that enable that different outcome. And that is not necessarily going to be natural. So yeah. We're trying to stick as close to nature as we can by restoring and supporting those hormones. So not to a stage where when we were 20, let's say, but at least hold ourselves at a steady line so that we can get our desired outcome.
And the hormones now are much more, or much less, should I say, synthetic than they used to be. And that's the bioidentical, et cetera. They're a lot safer, certainly, than the bad press they had, say, 10, 20 years ago, should I say. Mm-hmm. Natalie, I'm dying to get on to probably one of your favorite topics. Peptides. Firstly, for people that don't know what peptides are, can you give us a sort of a layman's description of what peptides are?
For sure. So I will start with this. Everybody knows one of the most famous compounds that is a peptide. Everybody's heard of it. It's called insulin. Insulin is a peptide. Peptides are small proteins. Peptides and proteins are essentially made up of amino acids. And amino acids are what we call the building blocks of protein. So that's our foundation, right? So imagine your amino acids are like those single little Lego blocks that you or your children may have played with at some point. And when we put those Lego blocks together, we build a protein. Proteins can be super long. They could be hundreds and hundreds of amino acids long. A peptide, by definition, is a small protein, and it's generally 50 amino acids or fewer long. And they're the hallmark of any protein is that it's going to be folded in different shapes, and how it's folded is going to determine how it functions in the body, the receptors that it attaches to, the whole nine yards. Which brings us to, what does a peptide do? It's essentially a signaling molecule in the body, right? Because we've been chatting for a while and we may not, you know, have a huge amount of time left, I will say that the bioregulator peptides, which are essentially a subset of peptides, are only 2 to 4 amino acids long. So these are the tiniest of the tiny proteins. They are made in the human body. And of course, as we age, we make fewer of them. What the bioregulator peptide can do is it can cross across the cellular membrane into a cell. It can cross the nuclear membrane, which is the nucleus of the cell, which is kind of like the command center. And in the command center is where your DNA lives. And there, that bioregulator peptide will bind to the DNA, which means that it'll find its attachment site and it will upregulate the production of proteins. And what that really means is that it is essentially it's an epigenetic switch. This is when we talk about epigenetics. This is something that affects the expression of your genes. And when that protein is produced, what's really happening is that you're essentially generating a regeneration of whatever the tissue, gland, or organ that is targeted or that bioregulator peptide comes from originally.
So as we age, we're losing these peptides. And now, am I right in saying there are peptides that we can, there are things that we can take, or different mm-hmm. types of peptides that will help us rejuvenate these different parts of the body?
Right. Yeah. So the bioregulators typically are seen as a regeneration, rejuvenation kind of tool. The other peptides that are longer, but still less than 50 amino acids. So these are things like, and you know, some people are, their eyes are going to glaze over here. I apologize. Some of these are called BPC-157, which is BPC stands for Body Protective Compound 157. The number is not random. It actually designates number one to number 57 because BPC-157 is essentially a fragment of a naturally occurring protein that we secrete in our gut. When people isolated that fragment, they did so because they realized that this fragment of that protein actually is responsible for an incredible variety of effects in the body. And of course, a lot of the research is done on animals at this point. There's more and more research being done on humans. It's a different discussion for another day. But basically, this body protective compound peptide can be incredibly powerful for healing of muscles, tendons, and ligaments. So that would be musculoskeletal injuries. It can be very powerful for healing any part of the GI tract. So from the mouth all the way to the other end and everything in between. It's actually very protective for the brain. It's good for nerves. It's good as an anti-inflammatory. It's good for reducing pain. It seems to have, for most people, a balancing effect on neurotransmitters in the brain. So serotonin, serotonergic, dopaminergic and GABAergic. So serotonin, dopamine, and GABA. So these are the principal three of the big neurotransmitters in the brain. Also, because it affects the gut. We know that a lot of these neurotransmitters are made in the gut. What else? Oh, it's very powerful for wound healing. There's a lot of really interesting literature on it for burns. It can be compounded into drops for the eyes. I could keep going. So this one little protein can do a ton.
So before people sort of start Googling and just trying it left, right, and center.
I have that. Where do I get it?
Yes, where do I get it? Are there, firstly, how do you know you absolutely need it? And would you recommend source? I mean, we're here in the UK. I'm not even sure. A lot of things are not available here where they are available in the US. And in Canada, are there places that you recommend, or is there literature or information that you provide to people on this?
Good question. So to begin with, on my podcast, which is the Biohacking Superhuman Performance podcast, I've interviewed quite a lot of people. One of the reasons why I started that podcast was because I was wanting to know more about peptides. And I'm like, well, how am I going to get these people to talk to me? And it was like, I know, I'll start a podcast and then they'll talk to me. There's actually an entire episode that I did devoted to BPC-157. Oh. There are entire episodes devoted to bioregulator peptides. Having said that, the BPC is a very interesting peptide because it can be taken in many different ways. A lot of the peptides, especially the longer chain peptides, not the bioregulators, but a lot of those peptides have to be injected by subcutaneous injection because they are proteins. And even though they're small, if we take them orally, we will digest them and break them down into amino acids. BPC-157 is different because it is native to the gut. So it can be taken as a capsule. And there are definitely ways for people in the UK to access. And I would say over the last 3 years, a growing number of providers have figured out a way to provide these things in the UK. as well as even Australia, which has historically been impossible to get peptides into, has people in Australia. As a matter of fact, one of my favorite gut healing supplements, which is an oral supplement, is made in Australia by a company called Level Up Health. And it is the most beautiful stack of three different peptides, which is BPC-157, KPV, and lirazotide. So I'm sorry about all the big words, but basically, the BPC is healing, the KPV is anti-inflammatory and slightly antimicrobial, and lirazotide is a peptide that helps to seal the junctions between the cells in the GI tract. So some of you may have heard of a condition called leaky gut that we can develop, right? And that can be from eating the wrong foods. It can be from excess stress. It can be from a lot of different things. This one, now BPC-157, even on its own, can be very helpful for leaky gut, but lirazotide, it turns out, is like glue for that stuff. Wow. But on top of that, in this one supplement, you also get things like L-glutamine and tributyrin, which is a very important short-chain fatty acids to feed the cells, the colonocytes, so cells of the colon. He's put in zinc carnosine. So it's this kind of magical stack of all the things you could think of put together so that you can take two capsules a day and be done. So, you can order that online.
Is it safe? Has it been sort of scientifically tested?
So which one?
Thinking about this, the stack that you just mentioned.
So so here's, that's a really good question. And the answer you're going to get is going to vary depending on who you speak to, right? I will say to the audience that when it comes to double-blind clinical trials, we are lacking in human evidence, in human information. I will also say that the number of functional medicine doctors who are weaving these products into their practices and the amount of learning and research and all the stuff that's going on around this would indicate to us that there's some evidence that these are pretty darn safe. Mm-hmm. Having said that, we don't have full clarity. And there's a reason why you can't go to the drugstore and buy it off the shelf, right? Because none of these products are cleared by the FDA or the NIH or Health Canada. So they kind of operate in this funny little gray zone that for now, for the most part, they're not banned. The tragedy is that pharma companies have a massive influence on lobbyists, in terms of lobbying governments and the bodies that regulate supplementation and drugs in both our countries, in all the countries, really. And they're working very hard on two fronts. On the one front, they're working very hard to take peptides, modify them, and reintroduce them as as drugs. Mm. And we don't have time to get into this, but the most obvious of those are Ozempic and Mounjaro, these two fat loss drugs that are essentially peptides that have been modified by drug companies. That's like a whole other episode. But we have things like thymosin alpha 1, which is a thymus peptide, so very important for immunity, really powerful for people with autoimmune issues, and is approved as a medication in about 30 different countries around the world. But in the US, the FDA has gotten to the point where they're now not even allowing compounding pharmacies to make it. So they've literally pulled it off the market. So this is a little bit of a quagmire one in here, right? We've kind of waded into very swampy territory, because if you went to a place like if you go to one of the repositories that is the richest repository of research, so it's called PubMed, and that's website online. You go to PubMed and you type in thymosin alpha 1. So I'll spell it out for you guys. THYM like Mary, OSIN like November. Type in thymosin alpha 1 and whatever you want. MS, autoimmune disease, viruses, and the V word, right? Which I don't even know you want to say that, but
well, those I don't shots, mind. You can say it.
and it's not even COVID, like even with the flu shot, like there was a study that was done that showed that in elderly people who have a tendency when they get the flu vaccine, whatever you think about the flu vaccine, it doesn't often work for them because their immune system isn't functional enough to generate that immune response to the vaccine to protect them from whatever the flu is that they're trying to be protected from, leaving aside the conversation of how well they designed that vaccine that year, all of that, they were able to show that when they gave thymosin alpha 1 as an adjuvant with that vaccine, they had a better immune response to the vaccine, so they were better protected, right? So
I wonder if it helps people after they've taken the vaccine and not having side effects with it.
That vaccine, I can't say, because that's a whole, that's more than a rabbit hole. That I think we're getting into like a groundhog den at this point, right? So, but having said all that, I think that to answer the question of are peptides safe is a very, it's a tough question to answer. My personal opinion is that many of the better known ones are seem to be quite safe, but we don't have the clinical work, the traditional ways of assessing safety available to us. So I'm not going to sit here and say everybody should be using this stuff. I think that there's a growing body of evidence that certainly when they're needed, using them at that time in the right dosage for a short period of time under guidance has yielded incredible results for people. So really incredible.
If someone was just looking to say sort of optimize their health, would you say that that's something that they should look into peptides? Or do you think it's more something that if you've got something seriously wrong with you, or not seriously wrong with you, but you have something wrong with you, then you should consider?
So I think that, you know, for health optimization, you're going to want to work with someone and make sure that you're taking care of all the basics, and then maybe use them in short stints at the right time in the right dosages. I think with the bioregulators, we have a different conversation, because the bioregulator all these peptides originate in the body, right? But the bioregulator by definition is what the bioregulator does is it restores, or it tries to restore, homeostasis to the body. Homeostasis is a really big word that really just means balance. So a bioregulator peptide is not trying to push you over the line where you don't belong. It's really just trying to get you to even Steven. And that's not going to generate, a bodybuilder doesn't give a flying fajita about a bioregulator, because what they're looking for is bigger muscles than they should have, right? The nice thing about the bioregulator is it's very safe for that very reason. So if you have someone, for example, who has a thyroid issue, it doesn't matter if that is an overactive thyroid or an underactive thyroid. The thyroid bioregulator is there to help the body to come back, to help that thyroid gland to work better. So you can use it in both cases. So a lot of people at this point say, okay, well, isn't that kind of like a glandular, right? Isn't that like desiccated thyroid? I would say that the difference has got to be in the way that these are produced and purified, because the desiccated thyroid maybe is more raw. And so you can't give that to someone who's hyperthyroid, because you're going to just push them into overdrive. Whereas the bioregulator is probably more refined. There's less stuff in there, if you will. There's still cofactors, but not as many. And for the hyperthyroid person, it seems that it's just going to, over time, it may help to bring things down a little bit. Now, again, before everybody rushes off and buys as many bioregulators as they can get their hands on, know that we get the best effects from bioregulators under a few different conditions. Number one, we generally use them in stacks. So that's like in small groups. Number two, we use them in conjunction with the right lifestyle, supplementation. Like if we're trying to address thyroid, we need to make sure that the body has enough selenium. We need to make sure that there's appropriate iodine available. We need to make sure that we've removed, right? We always talk about adding, but we don't talk enough about removing. We've taken away the things that are compromising the thyroid in the first place. We're taking care of the adrenal glands. Like, right? So we have to look at the whole picture. And those bioregulators come in as part of your arsenal to help to bring that function back.
Wow, Natalie, I mean, you are a font of knowledge in this area. Where, if someone wants to get more information on this, do you have information? Where can people find out more about it? I know you've got your own community.
Right.
People join that. How do people sort of get involved with you and your work?
Okay. So like I said, there's some good episodes on the podcast for sure. I do have a private membership community that is on a platform called Mighty Networks, because I have a giant community on Facebook that's become really great and a bit of a three-ring circus. Not to mention the fact that when you're on Facebook, Facebook has a lot to say about what is said and how it's said. Yes. So a small group of people have joined me on Mighty Networks. They pay a membership fee. And if they join as an annual member, they get access to my peptide crash course, which talks about 13 of the top peptides of that other group that we talked about. They will also, at some point in the next little while, as soon as I get it together, get access to my bioregulator crash course, which is coming. It's just taking me a little while because I'm just a little bit busy all over the place. But I also do live Q&As in that group. And it's a really, it's a lovely community of people where we have some practitioners, we have a lot of lay people. Everybody is just very supportive. And like I said, I do live Q&As. I invite other experts to come in and do live Q&As. So it's a different kind of world. But that would be another place to get good information.
And we can put the link, we'll get the link and put that 100%. In the show notes. That would be great. Actually, I'm very conscious of time. Just a couple of last ones. Where do you see the future of this whole longevity and biohacking space, say in the next 10, 20 years?
Well, I think if we don't blow ourselves up first, it's going to be pretty amazing. Right. I think that peptides are definitely going to revolutionize medicine 100% if they're allowed to. But on top of that, you have things like stem cells and exosomes. Notice that some of the most incredible tools to improve and enhance and extend human life are things that are coming from nature. Things that originated in the human body and in nature are the most powerful tools that we're going to have for regenerative strategies. So As one of my previous podcast guests said, and I think it was Bill Lawrence in one of the first two bioregulator podcasts I did, he said he talks about a bridge, right? And it's the bridge between where we are now to that future you're talking about, where there's going to be these incredible regenerative techniques and whatnot. If we can keep ourselves healthy enough and functional enough to wait until that bridge is finished to where we are today, it's going to be very fascinating to see what's going to be available to us. I think that, you know, we may be our own worst enemies in getting there, but ultimately I think that the future for humanity when it comes to this stuff is very, very bright. There are people that are doing such incredible work in this space, and it's an exciting time. I think it really is.
Natalie, I feel like that's a fantastic moment to end on, because I think we could talk for ages around all these different topics. Finally, where can people find out more about you? We've talked about the podcast, the community. If someone wants to sort of connect, is there a way, easy way to do
for
it?
For sure. So the best way is that, so I have a website, natnidham.com. We took the whole big name out of play there. So it's natnidham.com. So that's kind of ground zero for me. You'll find everything there. And then on Instagram, I'm just at Natalie Nidham. And I think that's pretty much it.
Natalie, thank you so much for being a guest on my show. I've loved talking to you. Thank you for tuning into the show. Please subscribe and share. That would really help me get these valuable messages out.